Hi to all. In this Ziegfeld Philosophical Dialogues, the Story Behind the Work podcast, I will talk with Professor Brian Butler. Dr. Brian Butler is a professor and a senior associate dean in the College of Information Systems, iSchool at the University of Maryland. Dr. Butler has published over 100 referred articles in journals, conference proceedings, and edited books. His recent scholarly work has been published in Archival Science, Journal of the Association of Information Science and Technology, Information Systems Research, MIS Quarterly, Communication of the ACM, and Organization Science. His research interests include the development and modeling of online communities and social media systems, the interplay of power in information technology in organizations, and techniques for deploying complex information systems to support reliable organization individual performance. His recent work has examining the role of local information institutions and infrastructures in community resilience. In this podcast, we will talk about his eclectic approach towards usage of philosophical streams, his opinion on how to communicate your philosophical intuitions in research papers, the philosophical obligations of IS scholars, and much more. With this, I bring you Professor Brian Butler. Hello, Professor Brian Butler. Thank you for accepting being part of this Ziegfeld initiative on making podcasts with people that are related to philosophical issues, using philosophical issues in their research, and they to tell us their story behind their experience that can be, let's say, informative for other scholars, mainly younger scholars that want to be more philosophically informed in your research. Thus, I would like to kindly ask you if you can provide some historical overview about you, how you actually first engaged, and how did you engage with philosophical thinking, and then how you incorporated in your work.
Okay. So I think there's probably several different things. But first, I'd like to say thank you for inviting me to participate in this podcast. And I look forward to our conversation. But kind of historical or background of how I engaged philosophy, I guess I would say there's probably three different ways. One is around philosophy of science. At different times, I've taught a PhD seminar or different PhD seminars, and I've kind of delved into the philosophy of science literature in a couple different ways in order to help students understand what they're getting themselves into. In particular with that, I've had enough different students coming from different backgrounds, students coming with different ideas as to what research was, students coming who are in different disciplines in their core studies, that having the ability to draw on the philosophy of science has been useful in that. And I can talk more about that if that's of interest. Go ahead. So I was going to say there's two other approaches or ways that I've used it. One is I have a tendency toward wanting to get to what, for lack of a better term, I'll call first principles or dig into definitions. It's something that many of us, I think, have an inclination toward. And one of the easiest ways I've ever seen this is the number of people that when they're early as in their faculty career or as a doctoral student, they write a draft of a paper about some definition of a term or a particular theoretical construct. And they say it's critically essential that we be able to define X, define knowledge or define information or define complex systems or things like this. And so I found many people will write a paper like that early in their careers. And it's incredibly important exercise and almost never publishable. And what they're essentially, when I did that, I realized part of what I was trying to do was what philosophers do very well, which was interrogate particular ideas, interrogate particular ways of thinking. And so from there, I went into reading some different kind of philosophical examples. So I think there what it is I've tried to use philosophy and philosophical writing as a model of things. And then the third is there are some particular topics where I've ended up doing some reading and it's been particularly useful. So for example, I've done work with online communities. And then from there, you go very quickly into discussions of both privacy and public. and Publix. And so there's a variety of writers that have worked with that. In social theory, which borders on philosophy, I've done work with power and politics, and power and technology. And actually, for a while, really wanted to teach a course that was Foucault and Pfeffer, and how they had fundamentally different views of what power was and how it works. I've done things in linguistics and language, and you can't do that very well, I would argue, unless you're at least passingly familiar with some of the philosophical approaches to language and meaning, and learning and knowledge. And then more recently, there's some reading I did about, actually it was a theologian. I apologize. I can't remember the name. I was thinking I might go get the book, but it's in my office. And it's talking about what makes something an entity. So what is the difference between an object and an entity? I just found that for questions like that, philosophers, linguistic philosophers, social philosophers, they have a very different approach, and it's very useful to be able to read and get ideas from them. If I was a better philosophical scholar, I would do a much better job of having names of authors on the tip of my tongue. what I tend to remember is the way they've explained something or the way they approach something, and then use that in my teaching and in my writing. So those are the three different ways I came to kind of what would probably be called philosophy, to work with doctoral students and to engage concepts and to use in my own research.
And when you, because what I can notice that you are engaging broadly in reading different perspectives and different authors on, like you mentioned, on entity and object, where there are diverse thinkings about from different philosophers about more or less the same and the same issue. So how do you, let's say, in a way, prefer a certain philosophical stream, or you actually have more, let's say, open approach that what fits, you can use it, or you are more or less determined, like some people say, I'm critical realist, I'm postmodernist, or I'm positivist. How did you personally approach this?
So again, partially because I'm not as systematically educated in philosophy and philosophical thinking as someone who's made this a critical part or a core part of what their intellectual background. I would say I tend to pick and choose. So I have had classes where I have used Foucault, Latour, Kuhn, but then also, economists, which philosophically, if you try to mix them and make sense of them together, they have fundamentally different assumptions. And so rather than having something where I tend toward a particular viewpoint, I often will be interested in a topic, and I'll say stumble across, that's probably not quite accurate, but I'll find something that I think that I get referred to or recommended as being a good investigation of the topic, and then I'll talk with other people, and they'll give me a different perspective. And I tend to be eclectic is probably the way to think about it. Personally, I have more of a constructivist, constructivist perspective on knowledge and understanding of things. So I certainly am going to, if I had to put a label on myself, postmodern is probably accurate. Critical realist, possibly. I can act like a positivist for short periods of time, as many of us learn to do. But at the end of the day, I will often tell students, when you write a paper, the most interesting things are how people interpret it in ways you didn't imagine when you wrote it. And that's not a failure. That's actually one of the things that makes this fun. So if you look at it as I'm objectively assessing, describing reality and communicating it mechanistically to another person's brain, I suspect you'll be, I've just found from a practical perspective that you will be disappointed because people will read things in your paper you never imagined.
It's something like you have a story affordance. So the story affords different usages and different interpretations that actually maybe are different from what you when you wrote the paper.
And again, from a philosophy, both a philosophy and sociology of science, there's lots of different things, different scholars that have written about this and described different ways of thinking about it that are consistent with what I was just describing. Yeah.
And do you think from let's say from a perspective of writing a research, presenting your research in a paper and writing, do you what is your experience? Do you when you write it, you explicate your philosophical let's say views within the paper and why it's justified? Doesn't matter will it be this approach, another approach, or this interpretation, that interpretation, or that is more implicit based on your readings and interpretations? Because sometimes people tend to focus explicating philosophically. I think that this approach is more appropriate because philosophically I am informed by this, or this should be more implicitly stated in the paper. Why I'm asking this is because I was on some workshops where some senior editors raised the question and said, okay, if you write in the paper that you are, let's say, taking grounded theorizing or autoethnography, which could relate more to postmodernism, and then you try to mix it in your research with something that is in the stream of, I don't know, positivist or pragmatist or something like that, then we identify a philosophical distortion and we say this is not appropriate. What is your opinion? How you, or do you present your philosophical assumptions when you're writing a paper?
So again, I'll answer this in part as an author and in part as an editor.
Yeah.
What I've found is that personally, if I am unclear as to what assumptions I'm making, what approach I'm taking, mm-hmm. I often will end up writing a paper unclear in my own mind. So if I'm not sure what particular approach I'm taking with different things, when I go to write a paper, the paper does have inconsistencies that cause problems, just with making it readable and understandable and things like that. What I've found that works well, though, is that in many cases, once I understand how I'm approaching a question or a problem or a particular study, and can describe it, usually verbally, a lot of times that information doesn't get up put in the paper explicitly, but it does have a lot to do with what audiences I'm trying to engage, what venues I'm trying to publish it in. And then ultimately even how I frame the paper. So I guess I would answer your question by saying, I think it's really important that as a scholar, you understand, especially if you're a scholar who doesn't live in one tradition or one way of approaching things, that you understand in any given project how you're approaching it so that you don't trip over your own assumptions. But whether that ends up in the paper or not, in most cases I found that it doesn't. And I can give a good example of this. I have a project I'm working on right now that looks at precarious work, which is kind of a gig economy, flexible work arrangements in complex technical and organizational environments. But it does this by looking at a science fiction novel called Snow Crash that was published in the early 90s by Neal Stephenson as essentially a 450-page, I'll call it fictional ethnography, of a set of people that are trying to navigate precarious work arrangements in this complex environment. I have two papers that are based on this that are kind of drafted. One is essentially for literary theory audience, and that has I have to be very explicit about approaches that are being taken and refer to the streams of thought that I'm drawing on. The other is for an organization science or a management community. And there I don't, because there the answer is I have to be closer to traditions and ways of and sets of assumptions that are acceptable to that audience. Otherwise, they look at it as my colleagues I have a couple of colleagues that use the expression of they look at it like a cat looking at a salad. meaning they're intrigued by it, but they have no idea what it is or what it's for. And so I think that's what I found is that I, in order for that to work, I had to very much understand how I was approaching that and why I thought looking at a fictional discussion of something that we're seeing in our world made any sense at all. But then how I engaged that as I was thinking through two different audiences was very different. And I think that's what I found. The other example of this, where because I certainly can sympathize with what the folks at your workshop were saying, is it's very common to have something where the introduction has one approach and then the theory and background has a different approach and the methods and the study, empirical study, has a third approach and the conclusion has either a fourth approach or randomly returns to one of the other three. And doing so, you end up with a paper that is essentially accessible to no one.
Yeah.
And so if your goal is to change people's assumptions and encourage them to use it a particular approach, you need to be clear about that. And if your goal is to have those things fade into the background, you need to be consistent about them.
Yeah.
And I think that's may have been what you were hearing from them. Not necessarily that it had to be presented and defended. Yeah. Though you might, you do encounter that sometimes.
This is a very very good point, and I'm trying to relate it with your experience now. It's like it's good to have eclectic understanding for the philosophical streams, and in your process of thinking and managing and drafting your ideas is to be aware about the benefits and limitations of different, let's say, philosophical ideas or intuitions. But when you are writing a paper, to be consistent in, let's say, in one intuition or in one stream, to be able, even if you want to change that stream, to be consistent in your message in the paper.
And like most things, I know of several papers. One I'm thinking of by Lynn Marcus. Rudy Hersheim has several that are like this, where it is possible to blend multiple philosophical approaches. It is very difficult to do it well. So it's one of those things that you really need to be doing deliberately. The likelihood of you being able to accidentally blend philosophical approaches and have it come out working well in a paper is very low.
Yeah.
And so what I've generally found is that if I know what approach I'm taking and can write a paper or can do a study that's consistent with that, the likelihood of success is higher. If I'm intentionally blending two very different perspectives or three very different perspectives, that has to be done deliberately. And special attention has to be given both to you as an author and making sure even editors and reviewers are aware of that.
Yeah.
And that's because, again, for most people, you don't switch back and forth. You don't move from one philosophical set of philosophical assumptions to another in the context of a single paper.
Yeah.
That's not expected by readers. So if you're going to do that, you better warn them.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way to hear that is that, if you can blend multiple perspectives, but it's difficult. That's a difficult design problem from a communications and writing perspective and thinking perspective, frankly. It's not just the writing.
And for example, you write papers with co-authors. And now we were talking about you as an individual, but you write co-authoring papers. And what is your experience in like when you have these philosophical influences and you need to work with other two, three authors and if they have different philosophical intuition or different, how do you, let's say, work with group of people where the philosophical assumptions might be different or unknown or they are not aware? Especially if you're working with a younger colleague, which will not have a broader understanding of philosophical streams.
Go ahead. Yep. So there are two different levels in which I think philosophical thinking and writing and being familiar with them is really important for that. One is for philosophy of science and kind of what the nature of knowledge is, kind of as a way of thinking through what we're doing when we do research and scholarship, is very important, because it's if you work in an interdisciplinary context with colleagues from other areas, they have a set of assumptions even about what the effort, what the purpose is, and what's possible. And I, for a long time, have had experiences, for example, where I remember one year when I was a graduate student, where one project I was doing was with an economist, and one was with a social science, social psychologist, and one was with a rhetorician, so a rhetorical scholar, yeah, in the English department. And they had very fundamentally different ideas about what research was, and what you could even, what was even possible. And so that actually is that experience in particular is what led me to do more reading in that space, so that I could better understand and identify, oh, wait a minute, the reason why I seem to not understand what he's talking about is because he's using a different model of what research is. Yeah. So I found the philosophy and the sociology of science is very, very powerful for being cognizant of differences, even when your colleagues aren't. And being able to surface those makes, just very practically, makes collaborations like that more feasible. And then you end up in a choice. You either have to flex your perspective on what science is, what research is, or you have to find a colleague who can flex, or you can compromise. I mean, there's again, it's just a practical reality. Now, more fundamentally, I'm trying to think of a good example of this I've run across recently. Actually, the best example I have of it run across recently is a search committee I was running, where, yep, I had one person who is a critical theorist, one person who's a positivist psychologist, one person who is a technological determinist computer science person, yep, and I was the chair of the committee.
Yeah.
and we had to try and hire somebody to work with cybersecurity. And what, again, for me, what it's useful for is having read a variety of different perspectives and done the work of trying to engage different ways of thinking, I'm better able to identify points of commonality and points that are irreconcilable. And I think that's fundamentally the challenge, is if you're working with collaborators, being able to identify things that are central to their way of thinking and recognize that you can't ask someone to abandon something that's central to their way of thinking.
But this example is very good. That means that I hope you hired somebody, because the whole group identified a person that meets all the requirements of the different philosophical streams. But this, what you said, is very important. That means that when you write, if you're eclectic in your philosophical understandings like you, then when you submit to some journal that identifies itself with certain approaches or certain intuitions, that means that you can direct your writing and researching in that direction to meet or to be able to engage in discourse with editors and the community that reads that journal. Am I right? Or
yes, and I think that's both freeing. So for example, I'm not in a business school at the moment. I'm in what's called the College of Information Studies or an iSchool. And we have one of my colleagues has a joint appointment in English, and she is a critical scholar. And I have several colleagues, including my dean, who are electrical engineers, and they are not critical scholars. they're very intellectually, they're very intelligent and intellectually inquisitive people, but they don't sit around and say, "What is the nature of data?"
Yeah,
it's not a question that they ask. And so I think part of the challenge in that kind of environment is being open, and also thinking very carefully then about who I would like to influence or who I'd like to engage in conversation with, and what's the best venue for doing that. And sometimes it is true that I run across things where I'm going, that's an interesting question, and I'm glad someone's thinking about it, and I don't want to. so there's not a, I don't think there's necessarily a moral obligation to pursue a particular approach. And again, this is a luxury I'll say I have as a tenured faculty member that doesn't always apply. Thinking this through when you're a new graduate student or a new faculty member, there's a different calculus, if you will, than what I'm describing.
Do you think when you say with the different calculus and the younger scholars and senior scholars, for example, or untenured and tenured scholars, I'm a younger scholar. So do you, I had once an interesting situation with people, senior scholars, saying that, okay, when you're younger scholars, try to meet the marks. So try to publish more papers in better journals. And then when you get tenured, start thinking about philosophical aspects, etc. I don't see that in your history, which you presented. So my idea is that, let's say it now from pragmatical perspective, a young scholar listening this podcast, from a pragmatic perspective, what is your thinking? Is it better to read now and get more eclectic on philosophical to be able to write, let's say, subsequently more assumptionally supported, philosophically justified papers, not philosophical papers, do not get me wrong, or it's better to focus more on, let's say, what they say, borrowing a theory, applied in new context, or extend it a little bit, again, in certain stream. So what is your thinking about that? Because you're also, you select people that get employed in your institution, or you advise PhD students.
So there's a couple of things I could say about this. One is there's a very cynical view. A very cynical view says, as a junior faculty member, you should do what people expect you to do and meet the expectations of the journals. And as a senior faculty member, you can write anything. And I can confidently tell you that as maybe I'm not as good of a senior faculty as some other people, but I have not experienced that you become a senior faculty member and they will accept all your papers. So that part doesn't apply. At least not. So if you think that you get to the reason you can do it when you're a senior person is because it's easier to get a paper through, maybe, but I haven't noticed it. on the flip side, I have found that telling someone you need to do jump through the hoops or meet the marks is demoralizing to a point where it's not helpful. So I would actually argue against the cynical view, but what I would suggest is, as you noted, kind of a pragmatist view, which is as a scholar, you are collecting ideas, you're collecting interesting problems, you're collecting possible data sources, whatever data means to you, or empirical context, you're collecting interesting examples, you're collecting possible collaborators, you're collecting interesting approaches. You should read and explore as widely as you have the time to do so, but also recognize that you're not in a sprint, you're in a marathon. You're going to be doing this for hopefully 20 or 30 or 40 years. And you feel like as a junior scholar, everything you read has to be applied. You've got to generate a paper every time you come up with a problem, something like that. And what I found is that that's not really true, is you're building a toolbox. And so there are things. So for example, I mentioned the snow crash idea, the precarious work. Where that came from was I read Snow Crash at some point long in the past. I had read some things, I think it was some Administrative Science Quarterly papers on precarious work at some point when that sounded interesting. I had a paper that was by Richard Sennett, a book, Culture of the New Capitalism, which is he's a pragmatist philosopher. He also has some things about the public. That's how I ended up reading his. And I had all of those things that I had encountered probably over the space of a decade. And then about a year and a half ago, I had an opportunity to take 3 weeks in what I call a mini sabbatical, since I don't ever get sabbaticals. I will take a 2 or 3 week time period where I go and hide. And I had started to read a paper, and I went, oh yeah, I've always wanted to know what I'd always wanted to figure out what I could do with Richard Sennett's The Culture of New Capitalism. Oh, and just to get myself started, I looked at what had cited it recently and realized that one of the precarious work papers that I had encountered in a different context had cited the Richard Sennett book. And I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. And then for some reason, I made a connection in my head to the snow crash, and that became a project. So I think it's really important as a junior scholar to be reading and to be gathering these ideas. The practical reality is, you may not want to be in a particular intellectual community, or you may not want to be labeled or boxed into one. But in order to get tenure, you have to have at least one community that wants you to be part of it. I mean, you can think about this in terms of getting letters. You need to, you know, getting your papers published, whatever. You don't have to have only that community. It works better for you if that community is one that is recognized by the institution you're in as being important. That's convenient. So what I encourage people to do, again, is read broadly, gather things, think creatively, but make sure when you need to that you prioritize developing a relationship with a particular community, recognizing that over your career you may develop relationships and engage with multiple communities over time. But that it takes 4 or 5 years to engage with a community. And you have limited time saying, I'm going to go to 4 different communities, conferences, and publish in all of those places. You're trying to do 4 things at once, each of which will take 4 years. You'll burn yourself out. So read broadly, think creatively, solve the problem you have in front of you, but recognize that you'll have time to cycle through multiple communities and multiple different projects.
And this, like, but it's like a question with sometimes is like information systems scholars, or like you read, you collect data, and then you apply it to your research. Do you think that there should be a return from that, like information systems scholars to engage in philosophy of science and actually make contribution to the philosophy of science? Is it this too much to be expected, or we should be, let's say, because if you go, you also mix it like philosophy of science and sociology of science. They like, if you, sociologists are, I think, good in coming up with philosophy of science ideas. Are we information system scholars positioned well because we are, let's say, we are a pluralistic field, different methods, we use different ideas. Do you think that we can spark some philosophy of science idea that will be returned in other disciplines to be? What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, I don't. So let me explain why I'm pausing. I should not pause in a podcast. That's not fair. But I think the challenge is, that's engaging in a different type of scholarship, right? So just as an example, that's not quite exactly what you're talking about, but I had some colleagues who are archivists. They study archives. And we did a paper and a project, actually a project and a couple of papers 3 or 4 years ago. And I partially did it because I was curious if I could figure out how to take what I know and the kinds of things we could learn in that study and engage in meaningful ways with a completely different academic community. And in particular, they're an academic community where many of the people are humanists. So they're humanists in a variety of different ways. And I learned a lot by doing that project. One of my co-authors was an anthropologist, and another one was an archive scholar. And I don't remember what, I think the other one was a folklorist. And we were able to come up with a paper that's actually been reasonably well cited and has prompted some interesting discussions in the archives community. But that took a lot of work on my part. I had to read a bunch of papers and learn how to, what is interesting to them and what is a meaningful question and what's a meaningful answer. And again, I, to a certain degree, by that point, had a luxury to be able to do that. Also, it's the kind of thing I tend to do. One of the problems with any approach that I have is that I go, okay, I've engaged with the archives community twice. I'm done. I know how to do it. And I move on to talking to somebody else, which is also not necessarily the most efficient way to do things. So I would say, could an information systems scholar hope to make contributions to philosophy of science, philosophy of language? I mean, there is actually a philosophy of technology. I think the answer is yes. The question is, do we want to? I don't think we have a moral obligation to do it. It's not as if we stole something from them and need to replace it. But on the other hand, if you have someone who is in a position to be able to do that and is interested in doing that and can do it well, I think that's something that we should look at doing. I think there's some really interesting things going on with in discussions of privacy and publics that are philosophical, certainly in the boundary of philosophical and legal, where having more IS scholars involved would be valuable. But again, do we have a fundamental obligation to do that? I don't think I'd go that far.
That's a very valid stand, because I tend to sometimes hear these comments. But what you mentioned is like, do we have a moral obligation? So we don't have to be pushing ourselves constantly that we are somehow obliged to move maybe in a different direction. But if there is somebody who wants to do it and he started as information scholar, it might start from some other field, then it's probably a way to do it in the future. And now when I'm in the future, you are also one of the guest editors for the Next Generation Information System Theories. And I don't want to presume, but when you talk about next generation and about developing new theories, but what is your, let's say, philosophical, in a way, stand on this? Do we need to be do they need to be incremental? Should they be radical? Should be new context? I read your editorial. I don't want to re-talk it or say that, but I would say the work behind it, that is why I'm interested, because if you propose an editorial like that, it's like, not editorial, sorry, special issue, you're thinking about that for some time, you know, I assume. So can you elaborate your vision for the future in a way? That is what I want to say.
That special issue is another really interesting example of the things we've been talking about. Susan Scott, Andrew Burton Jones, Sean Zhu, and I have, I think we, I would say, compatible approaches, but different. Mm-hmm. Both to, again, what theory is and what interesting questions are and why we're doing this, and also what makes a kind of which different kind of underpinnings or philosophical underpinnings they're drawing on. And the special issue actually was initiated by Arun Rai, who was interested in having this in MISQ. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that there is a practical reality for a junior scholar, there's also a practical reality for senior scholars. they're all mixed together. I approached this, and this is very much a sociological view of science. It's somewhat, I'll say, mechanistic is not quite the right word. But I have a paper with Susan Winter where we argue that to engage grand challenges, the issue is really being able to mobilize diverse collections of thinkers, of scholars, of researchers, of practitioners, to be able to look at that grand challenge from many different perspectives. Mobilizing them requires, I think we argue in that case, for boundary objects. You have to create problems that multiple thinkers can engage from their own perspective, but have enough in common that there's interplay between them. Yeah. I think the same is true for solutions, whether they be conceptual or theoretical or philosophical frameworks that are used to engage a particular aspect of a grand challenge, or talk about it or explain it or all of those things. So I think building the intellectual infrastructure to be able to mobilize intellectually diverse collections of people is critical for our ability to take on hard problems. And whether they be difficult problems or challenging problems in IS, you know, the interaction of artificial intelligence or emerging technologies generally, the nature of work, organizations, you know, that's a hard problem for IS. That's a grand challenge for IS is what is the future of socio-technical organizations, such that they can achieve the things we want them to be able to achieve, use the new capabilities of technologies, but do it in a way that allows us to continue to be human. That's a grand challenge for IS. Climate change and pandemics and all sorts of, there's plenty of grand challenges in the world that are not necessarily IS, but IS can engage. So either one of those, I think that what I try to do and what we were trying to do with this special issue, we'll see if we achieve it or not, is to contribute to building the intellectual infrastructure or frameworks needed so that, again, multiple diverse communities of intellectuals can engage these kinds of challenges. And I would actually argue that's what we're, when we're doing theory writing, that's my argument, is that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to provide something so that other people can build on it. Again, whether that is a discovery process, meaning you're discovering an idea and verifying it against an objective reality, or articulating a particular viewpoint from a particular human, or critically challenging assumptions that people don't realize they have. I personally find those to be different ways of describing much of the same work. because I haven't yet gotten to objective truth that I'm comfortable with and stopping, but I haven't, but I speak way too confidently to believe that what I'm saying is just my opinion or my perspective. So I think practically that I end up with some amalgam of them, and I'm comfortable with people that want to take a stronger position on any of them. I mean, in terms of next generation, I think all there we were trying to get at, frankly, was the idea that there, you know, in order to publish an MIS quarterly, you need to make an incremental contribution to theory. So you don't need a special issue to solicit papers that make incremental contributions to our thinking. We were trying to say, what are some other directions? What are exploration, exploitation, what are some areas for exploration, and what do we need to be able to go in those directions? And like I said, we'll see at the end of this year how successful we've been. It turns out it was actually a very challenging, running the review process was very challenging. Because our reviewers are very much trained to look for that incremental contribution. I mean, all of us are. I wouldn't say that.
That is what I was self-reflecting now and said, when I read the paper, I always look all these things, which literature, how you position it, what is the incremental, how you overcome, etc. And when you have this next generation where you are looking for more radical, let's say, more explorative ideas and theoretical propositions, maybe we need to be better trained in a way. Or
trained in a different way. I'm not sure I would say better. I think it's just different. You're looking for something different. The other thing, this actually has a practical implication for junior scholars, or actually has practical implications for anyone trying to write. I had a colleague that I worked with, I mentored, I guess it probably, I don't think I've ever actually co-authored a paper with him. But I remember early in his career, he presented something and essentially said, you know, this is a new method with data that nobody's ever had before. It applies a framing, a new theory, and it's in a domain nobody had before. And I essentially told him, I said, the reality is you've just described a paper that as an editor, I'll never be able to find a reviewer for. Every single thing. And it's like, you have to give me something to grab onto. And this is, if you think about it, if the studies of how companies develop new products, they don't tend to say we're going to have a new production method, a new technology, a new user base, a new market, a new, you know, they tend to say, well, I need these seven things for a product, and four of them, I'm going to do things we already know.
Yeah.
And two of them, I'm going to innovate on. Those tend to be far more successful than we're doing everything new.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually another practical way to navigate this is you've got all these pieces, you're excited about all these new pieces. Remember, your readers have to come along with you, or your students have to come along with you, or your collaborators have to come along with you. So think about how you would introduce some of those new things into something they already know. And I found that to be a much more effective strategy. And it's reduced frustration of having review panels or review panels that where you know each person is coming from a different field and the associate editor can't make sense out of it.
That's a very good example. That's a very good example in a advice how to deal even when you are aiming to create let's say radical new theories, but actually to build on something and engage with the community.
And ultimately, I think there's interplay between radical thinking and incremental steps. And again, it's a very difficult thing to do. I think that's one of the reasons. So we were talking earlier about an obligation to contribute back to other fields. I don't think we have an obligation to do that necessarily, but I do think we have an obligation to take on hard problems. Even with the universities undergoing change, as faculty, research faculty, we tend to have a particularly privileged position. And again, I recognize there's a wide variation there, so I'm not speaking for everyone. And if you have that kind of position, one of the things you ought to be doing is saying, am I thinking about a hard enough problem? And that doesn't mean you have to solve it, but you have some obligation to not take the easy route of the, you know, taking on easy problems.
To face also the grand challenges and more wicked problems that are happening where it's not clear how to solve them.
And I found the other thing that we have a luxury to do, and I have another paper that actually started on that same mini sabbatical. And I think this relates a little bit back to where we started with some of the philosophical thinking. It's a paper on data governance. And I read a bunch of the literature, and much of it is very practical. It's very practitioner oriented. And there's lots of interesting information in those. But what I was really curious about is if I start with three or four really basic assumptions, how far can I get for explaining what's going on and for understanding what could be done, both normatively and descriptively? Which is, again, it's a form of philosophical thinking that. And multiple people I've described this project to, I've had several people say, well, that doesn't seem very practical. To which my answer is, that paper probably isn't practical. Because I'm not trying to solve the practitioner's problem, which is highly contextualized, which is very particular. I'm trying to see if, as an intellectual exercise, if I start with some basic assumptions, can I either, I tried a mathematical model, but can I logically work out either ways of explaining why something is hard or even better ways of approaching it? And maybe I'll get there and maybe I won't. but I think I will have a different way of explaining it. Having a different way is itself a contribution, because ultimately I think that's how we solve hard problems, is we have lots of people that come at them from different perspectives. We collectively work through, you know, which of those framings or ways of thinking of it are most effective for different purposes. And that's how we move forward. And that's actually what I found is that's, for me, that's the enjoyable part of this and why I end up with the, as we described earlier, an eclectic perspective.
That is what I wanted to mention, is that you find historically in the past and now in the present and also identifying it for the future is this eclectical approach, maybe not eclectical understanding of different positions, different perspectives, and trying to find these boundary points among them in order to provide more, let's say complete solution. I don't know, complete, not complete, but let's say at least not too partial solution for different problems. Is this a good summary of your approach?
That is a very good summary of the way I approach things. And it's very important to recognize that I have colleagues who are, I don't want to say the opposite, but who are specialists. That even sounds negative. No, they're experts. Actually, that's probably the way to put it, is they're experts. Yeah. And I know people who have spent years and in some cases decades exploring, developing, applying a particular approach and a particular set of ideas. And that approach is incredibly valuable. There's things that I can't do using the approach I'm describing.
Yeah.
That they can. And I think that there's a place for both. And again, generalist specialist is some way how it's described, but I find that to be a misleading labeling.
Yeah.
And I think that's so I suspect you'll find some other folks that are focused on the philosophy in IS who are deep thinkers in one approach or one tradition.
Yeah,
and it should. What everything I'm describing shouldn't be heard as that's wrong. Yeah, it's different people.
Yeah,
and I think the world needs both.
Yeah,
and the discipline and the field needs both.
Yeah, this is a very good ending. The field needs both, and the world needs both. So I think that I'm happy that I got in this podcast you as a person, as one of this yin-yang, let's say it like that. With this, there is different perspectives, and then we should find our boundary points in order to solve these problems. And this is okay, but it's also okay to specialize in one perspective and make contribution there. Is something with which I want to close our podcast and to, let's say, ask you if you have something else which you want to add for the listeners, or we will just say that this was an excellent talk with you.
I think that's a good place to end.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I hope that we will have again opportunities in the future to talk again and go much more deeper in certain aspects. But the time planets around 1 hour for everybody, and I think that we are just coming to that. One more time, thank you very much, and I wish you a nice day.
Okay, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you. Ciao, ciao.
Bye. Bye.